My name is Roy Seeger. I'm an American Lutheran Church missionary, pastor, and have been in Latin America, especially in Colombia, the last 7 years, and have done some reflection, most specifically in the last couple, 3 years, about the situation, not just of the Lutheran Church or of the Christian community in Latin America, but what is all of the socioeconomic and political situation of that people. It's a very diverse people. And I'd like to say just a few things about the situation that we confront in Latin America this morning. What I've really done is answered all of the questions, and we're going to just resolve all the problems of Latin America, and I got it on one sheet of paper. I figured since we only have 1 hour, we might as well do that. The title that we gave to this was The Church, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. We want to make it much broader than that, however. But I would just say that Nicaragua and El Salvador are being used as examples in Latin America, as has Cuba been used as well. Nicaragua is seen, generally speaking, by Latin American people as a successful example of a revolution which brings about a change that's substantial. And El Salvador is seen as another example, but one that is now in process and has been very much complicated by some overwhelming presences by people who are not El Salvadorians. Some of them are North Americans, yes. So I'd like to make three comments in a general way and then say some specific things, and then we'll maybe have about a half an hour to solve the problem, so that we can go away feeling good. I know some of you are going down on the boat today, and I don't want you to leave here without thinking that we've dealt with Latin America and everything is all right. I've been a pastor for 11 years, and that's why I say that. So the three things I want to talk about, I want to make some comments, first of all, about the political situation in Latin America. That's a dangerous thing to say. That's like talking about the political situation in Europe. It's really hard to generalize, but there are some general themes that are common to most all countries in Latin America. Then I want to talk just a few seconds about the role of the church, or how the church has been involved in what's going on in this changing, rapidly changing political economic scene. First of all, the Latin American church, how it has responded. And then second of all, the U.S. church, and in that I guess maybe we could talk about the North Atlantic Christian community, talking about Europeans and North American Christians. And then finally, just make a few observations that are very personal and highly subjective about some of the things that we need to do as Christian people. So first of all, about the Latin American political scene. Latin America is still under an overwhelming feudal system. And in almost all the countries of Latin America, the conquest that took place in the early part of the 16th century implanted the form of government which was the accustomed form in Europe at that time, which was feudalism. And many of the people who came to Latin America right along with the conquistadores and after them came with the idea of establishing empires. That was done. And the oligarchy which was established now 400 years ago is still very much in place. And there are some examples of people who have tried to throw off that oligarchy. In Mexico, for example, there have been three sweeping revolutions in the last 200 years, and yet the very same families, essentially, who controlled the all of that territory in the late 1500s still control it today. We find that same kind of situation in all of the other Central American countries. From time to time, the family names will change. And from time to time, it'll pass from a father to a cousin, perhaps, or to some other more distant family member. But essentially, the same people are entrenched as rulers and controllers and landowners in Latin America that have been there for 400 years. That's hard for us to imagine, but it is the situation. There's also a situation of cheap labor, which for outside industries, North American or German or French, industries is a real plus, and it's a reason to become involved more actively in Latin America, because cheap labor is an important resource in order to be able to make products that are more saleable in a world market. But to the Latin Americans, what that means is low wages. The other side of cheap labor is low wages. Most people in Latin America work for a monthly wage that's less than $90 a month. And those are the great masses of people who work in factories or on farms or in small industries and in large industries all throughout both continents, I guess if we can call Central America a continent, as well as South America. The oligarchy then, this entrenched group of people, which comprises between 5 and 15% of the population, depending on what kind of country you're talking about, which country you're talking about, has obviously a great stake in maintaining the status quo. They don't want things to change, and they have become extremely wealthy. There are lots and lots of people in Venezuela or in Colombia or even as far south as Argentina who weekend in Miami or New York City or California. We have lots of people, for example, I lived in Bogota, where a great number of the rich people in Colombia live, and I knew personally 10 or 15 people who would spend 10, 12 weekends a year in Miami or in Madrid or in whatever place struck them to travel to on that weekend. The car that my little six-year-old son knows best when he sees cars and he likes to identify them is the Mercedes-Benz, because all of the people in the north end of Bogota, where the wealthy people live, have several different Mercedes. And he was asking me the other day why he doesn't see as many Mercedes here as he has always seen in Colombia. So they want to maintain the status quo, and they have built walls, literally as well as figuratively, around their properties, around their interests, in order to protect them. Another factor extremely important in Latin America, and I think it's really hard for us to even imagine it, is the overwhelming foreign economic presence. 70% of all capital investment in Latin America is controlled from outside of Latin America or from inside Latin America by outsiders. Now, if you can try to understand this, let's suppose that, if some of you are from Washington, let's suppose you bank at CFirst. And let's suppose that you found out that the president of CFirst, Seattle First National Bank, is Muhammad bin something or other, and that 56% of the investment that CFirst owns was controlled by Saudi Arabia. Or let's suppose that you know about the Boeing company, where I worked for a few years, and that you found out that the Boeing company was controlled by Polish interests, and or that you work for General Electric and you discovered that General Electric was controlled by Japanese interests, and so on. This is the condition in which people live in Latin America, and of course the ruling class, that 5 to 15%, is very comfortable with this, because they receive all of the perks, all of the money passed under the table, and there are lots and lots of benefits that they receive by having this kind of foreign capital investment. If you saw the film where it presented the visit of Dom Helder Camara to the United States a while back, and where it talked about the great economic miracle in Brazil, the so-called economic miracle in Brazil was a result of enormous capital investment by foreigners. And that's just fine up to a point, but I heard somebody complaining the other day and worrying about the Arabs who are apparently have big cash flows and are looking for places to invest, worrying about them buying up farmlands, buying up industries, buying up banks, and so on in the United States. I think it's a concern we have. It's an established fact in Latin America that way over half of all of the capital investment in the banking industry is run from outside. There are some trade-offs made to make it look better. Sometimes the ruling classes realize that they can't continue with this kind of posture. And so, for example, in Colombia, a new law was passed in 1977, which insisted that all banks be 51% owned by nationals, by people from Colombia. Well, what that has done is simply put the North American educated Colombians in as vice presidents or presidents or members of corporations for all the big banks. And essentially, they're still run from the outside, because these people are more answerable to Chase Manhattan in New York or to First National City Bank in New York than they are to the banks in Colombia or to the government in Colombia, for that matter. Most foreign investors, and I would think we could include the three main foreign investors in Latin America. There are lots of others, too. The three main ones are ourselves, North America, the Japanese, and the Germans. And the French are also very much involved, but not quite as much as those other three. Generally have stated, and starting in the 1950s, the United States had this policy as well, that they have two objectives. The first objective is development. And development has been and is being carried on by government agencies and private agencies and the church even. We were administering, when I left, I think Phil Anderson told me, LWF grants to the tune of $2 million in Colombia alone. Development is very much a part of the ongoing scene in Latin America, and it's something that we feel, and church people and other people feel, is a way to bring Latin America out of the underdeveloped stage and into the developed stage. There are some real problems with the whole concept of development, and perhaps the first problem, most serious one, is what it really does is create markets for products produced in the exterior. 10 years ago, no one needed a hairdryer or an electric toothbrush in Colombia, or in Bolivia, or in Peru. Now they do. And 10 years ago, when no one could afford to buy those kinds of things, or very few people could, now as salaries are beginning to creep up a little, they are becoming more able to buy these kinds of consumer products that are brought in from the outside. So many people in Latin America see development simply as a way that the great economic powers of the world have of expanding their markets. And the liberation theologians particularly, and other people as well, are beginning to question whether development is what's needed in Latin America. The other goal that's generally stated by us and other powers in the world, of the Western world, is democracy. We would like to see democracy established and maintained in Latin America. And I just have one question about that. What do we do when the majority chooses socialism? If democracy in its essence means free choice, liberty to choose your form of government, what is our reaction when those people freely choose socialism, as they did in Chile in the early 1970s? Well, it's well documented now what the response of the North American government was when Chile chose socialism. We worked with others to undermine that government, and it was eventually toppled and has now been replaced by a right-wing military dictatorship. Or what do we do if armed rebellion is necessary in order to establish democracy? That's another question. It seems that the prevalent attitude, at least in the Pentagon, if not in various administrations that have been in power in the last 20 years in our country, is that the established government, if it maintains some semblance of order, is more desirable and protects American interests better than any kind of freely chosen form of government. And armed rebellion is seen as something that disrupts order and provides opportunities for communism rather than a way to throw off oppression. Okay, that's enough of that. You can react to that in a minute. Or maybe it's better to react to that right now. Maybe you have some reactions strictly from the economic, political viewpoint, or some information. There are lots of statistics and so on, and maybe some of you want to throw some of those in or comment. Uh-huh.
Is it a large percentage of the foreign investment from the United States, even when you break that down?
Yeah. I don't know what part, but yes, a very sizable part of it, partly because, obviously, we're so close. The Germans are deeply involved, too. Most of us don't realize that. Even the people in Latin America don't realize how deeply the Germans are involved. The Germans were there at the time of the conquest, you know. Some of the conquistadores were Deutschmen, you know. And they came in 1520-something and established German communities in different parts of Latin America, which helped me to understand why it was that. And then there was a great immigration that followed that in the 17th and 18th century, And that's why I always wondered why at the end of World War II, lots of Nazis escaped to Latin America. I did not realize that there are huge German communities there and that they're not simply recent immigrants, but that these people have 400 years of history. I think that they're as bad guys as we are if we want to look at it in that respect.
Did everyone hear that?
That the German fellow that Rudy had met made the observation that there are two types of people, those who rule and those who obey. The Roman Catholic Church has had a great hand in this because the history of the Spanish Roman Catholic community has always been strongly hierarchical. And the people in Spain today still, I think, feel a strong allegiance to follow their church's dictates, and that's certainly the case in Latin America, even though probably of the 95% of the people who are Catholics officially, perhaps 10% of those people actually practice their faith, and the rest of them actually look down on the church. In spite of that fact, there is still very much a leader-follower kind of relationship between Roman Catholic clergy and hierarchy and the Roman Catholic laity. Anything else? Yeah, great.
You're not implying, are you, that foreign capital investment is somehow evil?
No, I'm not saying that. Foreign capital investment produces some very serious problems sometimes, and when it becomes the majority of capital investment, then I think you've got some serious problems, and I think that's where the problem is at. It's perhaps viable to have foreign capital investment all over the world and so on, but when it becomes so pervasive in a whole people, then it becomes very dangerous, and the economy then, you see, is ruled by what happens in Washington or what happens in Geneva, not what happens in Lima or in Buenos Aires.
I'd say one of the ramifications of foreign investment is it's happening in some places, particularly in Mexico, is the effect of a profit suck out of the country.
Yeah.
That for every dollar invested in Mexico, $3 go out.
Right.
There's only so much there to start with, and keep pulling it out.
Yeah. I think I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's really where it's at. For example, in Colombia, shirts are made, which are shipped to the United States and then imported and sold in Colombia. Sure. And that's a very common kind of thing. What is happening is just what this gentleman has said, that foreign capital investment tends to be a drain on an economy. And this is what's happened in Latin America, starting with the conquistadores, who took away all of the wealth. Unbelievable, incredible amounts of wealth were robbed, stolen, shipped away, much of it sunk to the bottom of the ocean, from the Latin American continent. And one of the reasons why it turned out to be a poorer continent, not only in terms of gold, but in terms of natural resources and other kinds of things over all those years. Somebody else? Yeah.
I've read that in the 40s after World War II, there were four military dictatorships in all of Latin America, and now there are about 16. And the U.S. has been implemented in almost every one of these changes.
Yeah. In establishing those military dictatorships. It really is. The Amnesty International puts out a map, you know, about the free nations of the world, and almost everyone agrees that there are two functioning democracies in Latin America, and they don't function too well. Colombia and Venezuela. All of the other governments are military dictatorships, either left or right, the great majority of them being rightist military dictatorships. And yes, excuse me, it's on record. In fact, you can go and read State Department memos and find out the kind of involvement that the United States has had in the establishment of these governments over the last 25 years, precisely because of what we have always termed our national interest or our interests abroad, which is to have peace at any price, almost. You know, we want absence of conflict in Latin America, because conflict makes it difficult for travelers, makes it difficult for our missionaries, for lots of other things, and certainly for our business interests. And we're always afraid that, as has happened in Iran and in other places, we're always afraid that our business interests are going to be nationalized suddenly and there won't be any kind of... I think it's a way to get at what's wrong. The problem is, precisely when you mentioned coffee, that most Latin American nations are involved in intensive production of export products like coffee. And the huge exports of coffee and the high price for coffee that we experienced here a couple, 4 years ago, was it, when coffee was so high? None of that money ever filters down to anyone out there picking coffee beans, that's for sure. On those non-essential exports, which is what most of Latin American foreign capital comes in to establish those kinds of industries, I think that boycotting is necessary and perhaps even the only way that you and I have a way to say something effective about what we believe and what we feel. I used to know a pastor that said that he felt that when a member came up to him and said, "Pastor, I'm not going to give an offering anymore here for this and that and this and that," he thought that was all right. He said they have a right to vote with their bucks. I think that's true. Yeah.
I think there are a couple things that I'm not used to dealing with. One of them is, why do we always have to look at the problem? If we're talking about the money capital being sucked out of an area, what about the agricultural land? I'm from Montana, so we have a lot of wheat and we've got a lot of beef, and yet you talk about transporting it out and about and coming back at worse than what they actually harvested. Same thing with beef and paying the high prices, you know, getting the coal that the East and other places are looking for and interested in, getting the oil that other places are interested in. And yet, when we say, as producers, hey, give the farmer something so he isn't just literally dirt cheap, you know, we go, "Oh, you mean I gotta pay, hey, I don't want to pay that price," you know, and that's sort of our own people. And when we just recently, the state, I'm saying we, I'm going to say Montana, just recently won the Supreme Court decision of all the stupid things, had to go to the Supreme Court to be okay that we were, that our 30% severance tax was not extreme when we look at a 68% severance tax coming out of Texas, you know. If you want to look at problems, I think we have a lot of them right here we can deal with.
Yeah.
I would like to take a look at the good side of what's happening.
We're coming to that, yeah. There's, the trouble is, yeah, the trouble is, trying to see the sun when it's raining very hard is difficult. The sun is there, and once in a while it peeks out, but I think we have to look at the reality, which is a very unpleasant kind of reality for the most part. And the complaint, you know, that the people who are actually doing the work that produces the product receive a very small part of the benefit from the ultimate sale and marketing of that product is exactly the complaint in Latin America. And what has happened, if I was going to make a very simplified and an overgeneralized statement about the situation, I would say simply this, that the very small group of wealthy people are totally immoral. And not only that, but they're stupid. They can't see that if they don't change their way of doing things, people are going to get to the point where they say, "I can't take this anymore." And that's what happened in El Salvador. That's what happened in Nicaragua with Somoza. That's what has happened in lots and lots of countries all throughout Latin America. People have said, "We can't take this any longer." It's not only that they're rich and we're poor. It's that they're getting much, much richer and we are suffering more and more. How can this be? And so that's, I think, you know, that's where it's at. But now let's talk about the church, because I think that's the only hope when we're dealing with the Latin American situation. First of all, the Latin American church, and when we say the Latin American church, we're talking about the Roman Catholic Church, because it comprises 95% of all the people who live in Latin America. And much to the consternation of some missionaries, I think it's not only foolish, but wrong to think in terms of converting Latin America to whatever, Lutheranism or CMA or United Methodist or anything else. I think that the missionary enterprise can have an effect and has had a very positive effect on the growth and change in the Roman Catholic community. But if there is an instrument for real radical change in Latin America, that instrument is the Roman Catholic Church. There are basically three responses that the Latin American church has had to this situation of oppression and of foreign control. First of all, there's an institutional response. officially or formally in the Roman Catholic Church, the need is recognized for radical and immediate change. There are lots of things that support that. You can start with the Bishops' Conference in Medellin in 1968, later the Bishops' Conference in Puebla in Mexico, later the statements of Pope John Paul II, not so much at Puebla, where he talked out of one side of his mouth, but down in Brazil, where he talked completely out of the other side, and where he said very definitely, and it was published in our newspapers and all over the world, that unless the church pushes the government, and unless the government takes a new perspective about the condition of the people that it rules, the whole situation is simply going to explode. So there are official institutional kinds of responses that mitigate for change. But practically speaking, the church is second only to the military in maintaining the status quo. The church is very much installed, as we say in Spanish, and it has become the great protector of the governments. The Cardinal of Colombia, Archbishop Aníbal Duque Muñoz, is a brigadier general in the army. And there was a great celebration when he was given his stripes and his brigadier's sword and all the rest. And it was as clear an example as you could want to see of the kind of marriage that takes place between church and state in Latin America. The church then institutionally, at the grassroots level, if you want to say it, is very much supportive of the whatever government produces peace. And they're very much concerned about revolution and revolutionary violence. And so the church becomes a great maintainer of the status quo. The second response of the church is a radical and revolutionary response by some people, a very small number of people, liberation theologians, priest guerrillas, people who are involved in consciousness raising, a term I mentioned the other day that's a term that comes out of Paulo Freire's book on pedagogy of the oppressed. Consciousness raising really means helping people to reach seditious, understand seditious ideas like freedom and human liberty, and to help people to see that what their condition is. Because the other fact of life in Latin America is resignation. People say, no, it's like this, it's always been like this. Yes, I know that my son has disappeared, and that my father was murdered, and that my daughter can't go to school because there's a corrupt official there, and so on, but there's nothing you can do about it. We just have to accept this. This is the way it's always been, it's the way it always will be. Consciousness raising seeks to break through that kind of resignation and complacency and teach people that there is another option and that they need to do something. So there is a very small group of people who are involved in this radical revolutionary alternative. And then finally, there's a kind of an alternative church functioning in Latin America, with which I've had a lot of contact. And personally, you can tell by my description of it, I think it offers some real possibilities. There are two ways of looking at this alternative church, or two manifestations. I mentioned the other day, too, a thing called the base community movement. In Spanish, it's called ecclesiastical base communities. The idea of base communities is to break down these enormous parishes that are the rule in Latin America, where there are 20,000 people or 15,000 people who are ministered to by one priest, to break that into manageable groups, and to get people perhaps in groups of 20 to 30 to 40 people to meet together on a weekly basis, most of them, and they meet around the scriptures. They study the scriptures, and they do what they call a Christian walk, or a progression of the Christian life. And they start with baptism, and they work right on through the Christian life. All of the sacramental and central events of Christian life. And you know what happens when people start to look seriously at the scriptures and share together and talk about their common concerns, is they become very much awakened to the situation in which they live. They don't need outside agitators. All they need to do is sit down once a week and compare the experiences that have taken place in the past week. The fact that they live in a society where there's no security, not even at a minimal level. You can't board a bus without being relatively certain that someone's going to steal something that belongs to you or beat you up, perhaps. You can't go out on the street and see any kind of military people walking around. They're very much present For example, in Colombia, we've been under martial law since 1974 without cease. There are always military people on the streets, jeeps with machine guns, men carrying submachine guns in battle dress and all the rest. And a week doesn't go by that someone isn't killed, accidentally or on purpose. And so there's not even the minimal kind of security. When people begin to meet together in little groups, and they talk about the scriptures, and they say, how can I apply this to my life? And they begin to share the kinds of things that are going on in their lives. You see what happens. They begin to say, this is wrong. The gospel says something different than what's happening. And these have had, the movement really started in Brazil, very powerfully, and now has spread all throughout Latin America. This movement has given real voice to a lot of people who have felt that there was no alternative. There was no way that they could possibly express their concern, make known their pain, their suffering. And then they're finding out that it isn't necessary to suffer quite that way, that it's possible to improve things. And of course, when they begin to try to improve things, they run into all the obstacles that the bureaucracy has put up or that the government itself puts up, and they begin slowly to think in terms of revolution.
Where does that small group movement type of thing fit into the political situation, for example, in El Salvador?
Yeah. The base community movement, in, for example, particularly in El Salvador, has been the point of reference for people who want real peace, not just the absence of conflict, but who want to resolve the difficulties, because there are some real conflicts in Salvadorian society, not only between rich and poor, but between neighbor and neighbor and so on. They're really looking for reconciliation. So those people find their support in that kind of a group.
Definitely not.
No. Uh-huh. It's the people who, the innocent people who are always caught up in the middle of all of this. Uh-huh. Yeah. It is Catholic. You bet. It is very much Catholic. An interesting sidelight in El Salvador, to show you what has happened there, the government has begun to pull out of the military the Roman Catholic chaplains, because many of them were Jesuits and many of them were very much alive to what was going on, and saying kinds of things to the military men that they didn't want them to say. They've begun to pull out the Roman Catholic military chaplains and put in Pentecostal ministers who will say to these soldiers, you know, kill them now and then we'll be with the Lord when we die. Jay? Yeah, it makes a difference in lots of ways. Yes, the Pentecostal movement is very strong. Stronger than the Assemblies of God Church is the Jesus Only Church. Also the Four Square Gospel movement, very powerful in Latin America. They move into poor barrios, poor areas, almost exclusively, and now they're beginning to work with rich people, which is an interesting sidelight too, but they move mostly into poor areas, and they give to people, right, they give them an hour or two a week in which they can simply go on a spiritual binge, get drunk spiritually, and forget about the rotten life that they're leading. And it's a terrific release for people. People just feel, they come out of those meetings and for several hours they're just floating. They don't need to think about the rottenness in which they live because they've been lifted spiritually to a new plane. It doesn't filter down that great spiritual experience into their daily life. And I've got lots of examples of that too. But that's the unfortunate thing. I think it could. I don't mean to put it down. But what it has functioned to be a real negative kind of import in Latin America, because it teaches once more the same kind of resignation to people that they already feel, and it supports that by giving them an outlet spiritually. This lady here was
Small groups meet with approved hierarchy in a Catholic church.
Okay, that's the best question. The answer is yes and no. Yes, they meet with the approval, official approval of the hierarchy of the church. But the hierarchy is, because there's nothing they can do about it. It has been decreed the papal legate to Colombia, for example, or to Brazil or whatever. It's been approved by the hierarchy, and it's seen as an evangelical movement, a way to evangelize people, to really get them to live out the gospel. And there's no way to criticize it. But the fact that many times it comes out in political conclusions and so on upsets the hierarchy very much. And so there are spies that function as part of the hierarchy who participate in these groups, but everybody knows who they are. They send them out on an errand or something and do the real business while they're not there. So it's a two-part thing, yes.
When it's so one-sided, are they ecumenical?
Not very. We have, it depends on the country you're in. Colombia, for example, is one of the most Catholic countries in all of the world, and certainly the most Catholic country in Latin America. And that means the most reactionary, most pre-Vatican II kind of country. It's one of three countries in the world that have concordat with Rome. They have a special relationship with Rome. That's Italy, Spain, and Colombia, where the Roman Council, or the, I don't know what he's called in English, the person who represents Rome and in the seat of government in Colombia can veto, has veto power over what the Colombian government says, and has great voice in the government. In other places, it's not quite as blatant as that, so that there's a little bit more openness. But even in Colombia now, ecumenism is becoming a reality. And I spent 5 days at a conference of priests and religious from the Ocaña Diocese in Colombia with the director of the ecumenical director for CELAM, the Latin American Bishop Conference. We did a five-day seminar on ecumenism. And people really opened and open toward that kind of thing. The trouble is that most of the Roman Catholics have had contact with non-Roman Catholics who are Pentecostal. And the Pentecostals, as I think maybe even that way here, I don't really know. But therefore, the Pentecostal, a Roman Catholic, is really Satan. And the whole Roman Catholic Church is Antichrist. And so you can't talk about, what they talk about in Colombia are Catholics and Christians. You know, we Christians are the evangelicals, the Protestants, the rest of the people are Catholics, which means heathen. So it's pretty hard to have ecumenical relationships under that kind of a situation. But we have done some things with the sacramental churches, as I call them, with the Presbyterian and Anglican and Lutheran churches, along with Roman Catholics. But it's only in the seminal stage. In other places, it's not much better, but a little better. Yeah. Jesus only? Jesus solo. Unitarian Pentecostal? Does that ring a bell? Yeah. It's a big thing in Latin America. They're the people that base their doctrine on the two verses in Acts where it says, be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ. Yeah. It's a very big movement. Yeah.
Leo. I was told by a man from Nicaragua last year that the event that sparked what was almost a spontaneous people's uprising that initiated the whole thing was a 16-year-old Pentecostal boy who was shot down the streets of Nicaragua. Invitation to a religious meeting.
Uh-huh.
And that event spread through the community.
It was one event. Uh-huh. It was one event. I think the unique thing about it was that it was a young boy, or the ordinary thing about it was a young boy shot to death in the street. Coincidentally, he was a Pentecostal. But yes, and there is a real, I don't know if we can call it real, but there is a serious ecumenical effort in Nicaragua, and there are two Roman Catholic priests who serve in the ruling junta, the group that is now ruling Nicaragua until they have elections. Two of these men are Roman Catholic priests. One of them I saw in this film, didn't I? Isn't he? No, I don't remember. No, it wasn't in this film. It was in a film about El Salvador. So the Roman Catholic Church has a different kind of presence in Nicaragua, partly because they've simply accepted the fact of the revolution. You know, and it is a fact. And the changes in Nicaragua that nobody can deny. Nobody can deny the changes have been positive that have taken place since the revolution. So for that reason, too, it's kind of held up as an example. Another example in Latin America is Oscar Romero, the Archbishop of San Salvador, who was murdered 2 years ago now, or 2.5 years ago now, while he was celebrating the Eucharist in San Salvador. Most of you heard about that. He has become, I think for all of us, a new kind of martyr, because Oscar Romero espoused openly peace, nonviolence, and justice. He criticized both the right and the left, and he was a worker for reconciliation. in a deep and serious way. No one knows which side it was that murdered him, but most of us are saying now that it was both sides that murdered him. The conflict that that is going on is what killed him, and the inability of either side to be able to put down their arms and begin reasonable discussion. So he has been kind of a rallying point, and in the base communities, for example, when we celebrated Oscar Romero's the anniversary of his death in March, we had a huge reunion and a meeting in Bogota where lots and lots of people were representing all different Roman Catholic groups that are working for peace and justice. A very strong movement in Latin America for what's called the horizontal church, or the people's church. And by the horizontal church, what is meant is a church which no longer makes distinctions between Protestant Catholic or between Protestant Jew even, or any of those kinds of distinctions, or between Colombian and El Salvadorian. The church now is the church of those who practice their faith and follow the leadership of Jesus Christ. And that cuts horizontally across national boundaries, across denominational boundaries. And that is becoming a growing reality. That threatens the Roman Catholic hierarchy, the Lutheran mission. It threatens all of us. It threatens government, because all of a sudden what you're talking about is a new kind of concept. Well, it's not really so new, but a new kind of concept for our day and age. We are talking about Christians being united and looking at how to reconcile, at how to throw off oppression, at how to begin to live in peace without necessarily getting involved in violent revolution, and how can we support one another in different countries and become part of this one movement, which is a movement for Christ and against the kinds of terror that we have lived under in the world. This horizontal church, or people's church, is very much an underground church. It's not spoken about. There are no lists. There are no offices. Nobody says it. Nobody speaks that word unless you're sure the other person you're talking with is safe. Then you can talk about the formation of the horizontal church. And many of the young people, the ones that I work with, for example, some of whom are Roman Catholic, the rest mostly Lutheran, are involved and are becoming more deeply involved in this movement. They want to live their faith, and they don't want to be impeded by the kinds of divisions that have always kept us apart. And I became very much interested in this movement and sympathetic to it, and even involved in it some myself. And when I come back to the United States and find out that the Missouri Synod has voted to end fellowship with the ALC, it doesn't make any sense to me. You know, it just looks like absurdity. The church is going somewhere else. It's not going that way. It's going that way. And I think we're going to find that this concept of the people's church or the horizontal church is going to grow. People like Robert McAfee Brown, for example, feel kindred spirits with other people in different nations of the world who are involved in the one Christian community, in the one body of Christ. That becomes the new reality rather than a patriotic national reality or an economic reality. Okay, what's the response of the church in the United States, the Christian community in the United States, to what's going on in Latin America? Well, you'll have to tell me. The only thing I know for sure is that one time not too long ago, three Lutheran presiding bishops wrote a letter to the president about the involvement of the United States in El Salvador. I think I'm right on that. I read that, I believe it was maybe in the Lutheran Standard or in Perspective or somewhere, that the presidents of the ALC, LCA, and AELC had written a letter to President Reagan about the U.S. involvement in El Salvador and that we should not be involved there militarily. That was a church response. There's a great dearth of information about Latin America, and most people just don't know what's going on. Most of us don't feel involved. And later I'm going to say just a word about that. I think we need to be involved selfishly, if for no other reason. Latin America is very important to us and is going to become increasingly important to us. People can't believe that they are involved, but we are involved in this situation, and we are part of, whether we like it or not, what is considered in Latin America as an oppressor. And we may not feel like oppressors, or we may feel that our government is not oppressing anyone, or that our transnationals that are based here aren't oppressing anyone. And it's okay to feel that way, but the fact is something else. They work oppression accidentally or on purpose for peoples in the third world. Let me just make a few personal observations, and then we'll have a few more minutes. Good deal to talk, and I can learn some from you folks. The first thing I want to say is what I just said. We've got to take seriously what's going on in Latin America. We've got to try to understand why it is that democracy doesn't seem to work. Maybe never will work there. Maybe that's not the form of government that's most usable for the Latin Americans. We've just got to try to understand them better, and we haven't done much of that yet. Their church models or their evangelical models, what does evangelism mean, may have something to say to us. When we went up in the mountains and a priest and his little group of actors put on a sociodrama for us, where they dramatized the murder of a Panamanian priest, he was from Colombia, but he was murdered in Panama by the government. They dramatized that for our group. Afterward, the priest, who was just a beautiful, beautiful man, and a very, just an example of peace and nonviolence, stood up and he said, "Roy, do you think that's evangelization? Is that evangelizing? That's a different model of evangelism than we would think about, but it is evangelism. Maybe we've got something to learn from those models, and maybe we ought to know more about it. Maybe there are people we could invite to come and talk with us about it and help us to understand." Another point that I thought about this week while we were talking about nuclear disarmament and disarmament in a general way, and the reactions to the possibility of disarmament, because I kind of feel, you know, all different kinds of things on that too, but it struck me. We can't have it both ways. We cannot say that it's okay for us to throw off oppression by force of arms, but it's not okay for them. You got that? Boy, that just came into my mind and exploded when we were talking about this whole business of disarmament. We are ready, are we not, to throw off whatever oppressor that tries to control us by force of arms if it's necessary. But when the people in El Salvador rise up to throw off oppression by force of arms, we say, "Oh, heaven forbid, this is wrong." You can't have it both ways, folks. Either it's okay for us and it's okay for them, or it's forbidden for us and it's forbidden for them. Think about that one for a while. Another comment. I think it's more important to make Christians out of Latin Americans than it is to make them Lutheran or Pentecostals or some other group. We have really committed a sin in Latin America, and maybe some of the other missionaries who have worked in New Guinea, where the situation is slightly rather different perhaps, or in Madagascar, where it's been quite different, can say some different things. But in Latin America, we have gone and implanted every denominational difference, every distinction, every hairline argument that we have had in the North Atlantic theological community over the last 500 years. So that in Colombia, there is the Wisconsin Synod Lutheran Church, and they won't talk to the other Lutheran church. They're Colombians. You know, what stake do they have in that? No, there's Cumberland Presbyterian, and there's the United Presbyterian. And they fight with each other. Why should they be involved in those kinds of things? So we've done this in Latin America, and I think it's important for us to realize, and maybe the day will come when we can send missionaries to Latin America who will evangelize and Christianize within the confines of the Roman Catholic Church, and they aren't Roman Catholic. That we may come to that day. I would like a call like that. Another comment, and I guess I said this before too, socialism may be the best option for these people now and forever. I see once again the reaction of our government, and I've heard it from overseas. When François Mitterrand was elected premier in France, you know, our government had a negative reaction right away. The people chose. Isn't that the basis of what we consider important? The people chose, and they chose socialism. Can't we live with that? Maybe not. And the last thing I want to say is that Latin America is a great big huge pressure cooker. Let me tell you, I am so glad that we made it home safely. And I say that in all sincerity. A missionary was murdered in February in Colombia. The word at that time was that all of the names of all the missionaries are on the list. At the M19, the M19 movement, one of the most popular revolutionary movements in Colombia, had all these people on the list, and I think they were saying that to be generous, hoping that we'd all leave. I had planned my leaving a year before, but it's a pressure cooker, and it's going to explode. We have only seen the tip of the iceberg in terms of armed violence in Latin America. And don't be dissuaded by what you read. In Colombia, the M19 had a big movement into the southern part of the country, this big revolutionary movement. Maybe it was even written up in some of the U.S. papers about 2 or 3 months ago. And the government won a great battle, a great victory over the revolutionary forces, and they murdered, they claimed, somewhere around 200 people and captured all of the leadership. Well, right away, the young people that I work with said, you know what they do? They probably caught a band of guerrillas. They probably did. Maybe 20, 30 people. Some of them, they got chased into Ecuador and so on. And following that battle, there came daily reports. Once again, the army has triumphed, and 25 people have been killed. So I asked my young people, I said, what's going on? They said, no, it's a very simple procedure. They round up a few campesinos who no one knows, murder them, take them into the central square with having placed upon their bodies grenades and all kinds of stuff. And they say, see, we murdered 20 more guerrillas. And even the people in the little villages don't believe it. They all know what's going on. So we get lots of misinformation. But there's going to be lots more armed conflict. And it's going to be bloody and unpleasant, much as the situation has been in El Salvador. And the answer is not for the great powers of the world to make pawns out of these little countries and to play who's going to control between them. And right now, I realize that it's quite probable that many of the arms that are being used in conflict, for example, in El Salvador or even in Guatemala, come from the Soviet Union. But a great, much greater percentage of those armaments come from the United States. And not only that, but now we have military advisors in El Salvador. We have military advisors in all the countries of Latin America, and all the military, the repressive military regimes, all these people were trained in the United States. You know, they were trained in counter-revolutionary activity. So we're involved deeply, and I think we've got to examine our conscience, and then we have to begin to speak out, if not as a united Christian community, as individual Christians. Okay, that leaves you a few minutes now. Yeah, back there. Uh-huh. No, him.
I wonder what the position of the Lutheran Church in Colombia is. You mentioned the Pentecostal and also the Roman Catholic. Is the Lutheran Church entrenched with the oligarchy as well? I got the feeling that your congregation was a group that administered to the peasant class, perhaps. But is the hierarchy of the Lutheran Church in Colombia, are they oriented that direction?
They're in a,
you mentioned that they were threatened by the horizontal church, and that kind of made me wonder.
Yeah. They're in a process of consciousness raising, concientización. They are beginning to see, and when I left, the president of the church was reading Dom Helder Camara, and we had a meeting among the pastors where a Marxist sociologist came in and presented an analysis of what's going on in the country and so on. They're in a slow process. Lutheran churches in other parts of the continent are much more aware, much more alive. But still, generally speaking, there is a great deal of reticence on the part of the Lutheran community in Latin America to become more actively involved in what comes out to be a political conflict, you know, what has political implications. Okay, now.
I've been wanting to hear more for a long time about what the situation is in Nicaragua now, how things are evolving since the revolution. Do you know anything?
Yeah, there have been some really positive changes. First of all, the land reform program has really taken root, apparently, and great amounts of land that were once under the control of the Somoza family and all of the other rich families that controlled that country are being parceled out, and people are actually working them. They're already in cultivation and so on. So a lot of people who did not have the opportunity to live on the land, at least if not own it, now own pieces of land. There's been a tremendous literacy campaign. There's been a tremendous literacy campaign, and many young people in Nicaragua and also from other surrounding countries are helping in that campaign, and it's had some real results. And the ruling junta has promised elections. The Latin American promises, watch out. They promised elections for next year, and we're hoping that there will be popular elections next year. But yes, and I think the most powerful change is that the ruling group is made up of people that the country, that the generally the population trusts, whereas Somoza they didn't trust at all. Oh, yeah. Oh, you bet.
So they're a part of the development.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They're very much involved in it. And most base communities have a sort of a mission outreach aspect. You know, they're involved somewhere. They're involved with demented people who walk the streets or with the children who are left out on the streets, that kind of thing. They're doing some kind of outreach. Yes.
By our policy toward them, are we just driving them into the Soviet bloc?
I don't know if we're driving them into the Soviet bloc, but we're driving them further into oppression. Yeah. And if we wanted to be sure that they ended up with at least a socialist form of government, all we have to do is keep pushing the way we're pushing now. I'm sure they will. Yeah. There's truth in it in a general sense. You know, I don't think that that Chuck Biderman was actually doing that. Nor do I think the ILV, as it's known overseas, the Wycliffe Bible Translators, are doing that. But Wycliffe has made a tremendous mistake. And I, just as long as we mention that, for those of you who know about Wycliffe Bible Translators, and some of you support it, they've made mistakes. Their big mistake is going into countries, and they're established in many countries all over the world, something like 75 countries. They go in Colombia, for example, and it's very much similar in other countries. They get a special arrangement with the government, a contract, a signed contract, under which they get privileges that even the diplomatic corps does not get. They bring in airplanes, they get free gasoline, and what they did was they went down in the plains area of Colombia and they built a little Gringolandia, you know, two-story white frame houses. I mean, they just created suspicion. People would say, you know, they don't mix with the Colombians whatsoever. They do their specific technical work. I think Dave Bella could tell us some things about technology here. They do their technical work related to codifying languages, indigenous languages, and translating scriptures into those languages, and making them written and spoken, written languages, and so on. But they don't get involved with the country and its people and all the rest, and that creates immediate suspicion. And so the reaction of other peoples against this group, I understand why. I don't think they're mining uranium, as they've been accused of, or passing secrets to the whoever. I don't think they're doing that. But I understand why people are so suspicious, and I think they've brought that kind of suspicion on themselves by their mistakes. Somebody else, yes?
Well, they're parsing out land to these various people that aren't the big landowners anymore. Their amount of population is so great. How did that happen?
Okay, yeah, it's not as great as we think. The population problem isn't a problem in Latin America. Uh-huh. Most of us are convinced that the population is a big issue there. It's not. In fact, in Colombia, people are saying, even sociologists who are operating surreptitiously because all sociology faculty has been closed, are saying that they need population growth rather than to control population. There's lots of... Okay, it's done through government programs that are developed through the junta. That's one of the problems. For example, in El Salvador, there's supposed to have been a land reform program initiated last year. And it's only now in its most beginning kinds of stages. It's a good program, probably. The difficulty is who administers it, you know? And the people are promised these kinds of things, and they just never happen.
There's not a country in the world that I'm familiar with that has an insular agricultural economy that isn't poor.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when you move beyond raw agricultural development and start trading as Denmark did by taking their cow's milk and turning it into cheese and selling it to Britain or whatever, that you start to raise per capita income. And, you know, that's where we start getting in. When you have rising per capita income, you have the ability to send people to school, to purchase health care, you know, to do the kinds of humane things that we would like. This country did not develop on its own. We only started to develop in the 1860s when we got massive inflows of European capital to build steel mills, to build railroad systems, and all of the other things that we associate with our wealth and a growing and a developing society. I think it's a terrible mistake to say those countries shouldn't develop, they shouldn't have capital inflow,
yeah.
Because what we're doing is we're relegating them to an impoverished condition if we say that.
Yeah. I think, you know, the issue of development, what liberation theologians would say in terms of development is that world history has moved to a point where we cannot repeat the U.S. experience, for example, in Latin America. And that may be right or wrong. And they say that there's no way now for these other countries to get on the development bandwagon, and that there aren't resources available, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I have the same question, and we talked about this the other day, too, with Paul Hoyer. My concern is, you know, you say, okay, it's wrong for all this development, and so you keep people back or allow people to stay where they are or whatever, and you get less education, and maybe people die younger, and maybe that's all right. What? You know, I'm just totally convinced that longer life is better, but maybe it's not. And maybe they can work out in their own context their own salvation with fear and trembling, you know? I think that's where I have the most problem. I have a problem as a missionary and as a foreigner involved in Latin America. Maybe people ought to be allowed to work out their own situation, you know, without so much outside pressure. And now, you know, the television, for example, is developed in Colombia. It's simply a copy of this. But they don't speak to the kind of people that we're speaking to here with television's bad enough here. There it creates a whole negative impression for the entire populace. So there are some real bad models. But I'm with you, Greg. I don't think we can simply say that development is bad universally, period. I still have lots of questions. But I see that, and for that reason, for example, even Phil Anderson, my missionary cohort in Colombia, is still very much involved in development. And he's a liberation theologian, too. Because putting in a water system for some people who don't have fresh water and are getting sick because of that, you know, but then you put in the water system and then you put in an electrical grid and maybe you're doing a lot of bad along with the good. I don't know. It's pretty hard. Anything else? We're over. If anybody wants to go is welcome to leave. Thank you for your time. But anybody else who wants to chat?